From beanies to carry bags and from shoes to caps, browse our shop now at tntradio.live. Critically analyzing global affairs, this is the Hervoy Moritz Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
On the anniversary of the Ukraine war and President's Day weekend, TNT Radio is the proud sponsor of the Rage Against the War Machine rally in Washington, D.C. at the Lincoln Memorial at 12:30 p.m. Washington time, Eastern time, this Sunday. The Rage Against the War Machine features veterans, speakers, rock musicians, comedians, and more, some of which I have interviewed. After the rally, we'll march to the White House and deliver our demands to warmonger-in-chief Joe Biden. Those demands are not one more penny for war in Ukraine, negotiate peace, stop the war inflation, disband the North Atlantic terrorist organization, global nuclear de-escalation slash the Pentagon budget, abolish the CIA and military-industrial deep state, abolish war and empire, restore civil liberties, free Mr. Julian Assange. And for more info, visit tntradio.live and rageagainstwar.com. And or keep listening to TNT Radio. I was trying to make a donation to Rage Against War today, and no success at all. I think the powers that be don't want me to give money to them. It was really, really strange. Used all of my options that work otherwise, just not at rageagainstwar.com. Really, really strange. All right. What's going on in the news today? Just everyone's just talking conspiracy theories today. Elon Musk at the World Government Summit just banging on about world government. He says he spoke out against the idea of a world government at the World Government Summit and warned it could lead to civilizational collapse. So is it safe for us now to talk about world government, or is it still a conspiracy theory? Lula, earlier this week, remember, was telling Biden, we need a world government. And Elon Musk is like, no, we don't need a world government. So I can't believe like we're here. This is it. This is it. I had to share a clip from Conrad of World War Now. He's been a guest on my TNT show last year, the podcast. He said, Sturgeon, Malpass, Ardern, all neoliberal icons resign. Moldova government collapse. Raisi meeting with Xi, Turkey accusing U.S. of direct hostility, chemical spills and derailments across the U.S. UFOs. It's World War III, all right. Something is brewing. That helicopter crash, was it in Alabama? Really, the hair is standing on the back of my neck. It's like, yeah, it's really, it's here. The 2020s are going to be one for the books. If there are any books left after the 2020s. Someone in Davos was smiling because the Lufthansa IT meltdown strands thousands of passenger. IT failure stranded. I think Lufthansa canceled all flights. More than 200 flights were canceled in Frankfurt, a vital international transit hub. And I know because I have often flown through Frankfurt and with Lufthansa. And so good thing I wasn't on my way to Croatia just now. That would have sucked. But yeah, what have we been saying for months, if not years? These types of things are going to increase in frequency, internet down, electricity grids down, these, you know, networks down. They told us it was going to happen. It's happening. So, I mean, it's really not shocking or surprising. And the Welsh government is going to axe all the country's major road building projects, and no more will be built unless they won't cause more cars or higher emissions. So just like the Saudi minister at Davos said last year, there will be no cars in the future. And then the Welsh government says, we're not building any more roads. Again, who's crazy here? I mean, it's just extrapolates. No, you're not going to need cars. You're going to be walking if you have enough social credit to leave your zone, which will be, you'll be tracked by the, you know, the geolocation. So, Hey, we're beta testing the Mark of the Beast system here. Fun times. What can I tell you? Fun times. What Wall Street Journal says, to save money, maybe you should skip breakfast. Maybe the headline next week is going to be, to save money, maybe you should just go kill yourself. I mean, really, like, you can't even invent these headlines anymore. It's just, you know, given the other stuff we were talking about this week, Japanese academic says all of the, there should be a mass seppuku of the elderly in Japan. Skip breakfast. We're not building roads anymore. EU says no more gas-powered cars after 2035. I mean, this is like we're unplugging, you know, that Metallica song, Hardwired to Self-Destruct. And Guardian continued. I don't think I mentioned this one. Want to truly have empathy for animals? Stop owning pets. Yeah, don't have pets. I mean, I was shocked. I thought the headline would be like, eat your pet, or you know, something to that sort of, yeah, to the tune. But we sure are in Twilight Zone. It's Twilight Zone times. And a again, a reminder to download the TNT Radio smartphone app. You can listen with that app live anywhere through your phone. Get it from the Apple App Store or Google Play Store. Or if you have a de-Googled phone, you can get it from the Aurora store and listen to us live anywhere, anytime, anywhere you got a signal. Stay up to speed with us on TNT Radio.
The news you want.
They cover the important story.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
In a seemingly preemptive move against a possible false flag attack, Russia's defense ministry is warning that Ukraine and its backers are planning on accusing Moscow of causing radiation contamination. Here with the full story, joining me now is TNT Radio news producer Adam Clark, a.k.a. Ruckus.
Thanks, everybody. Well, before we get into this one, this is breaking news, and I feel like I absolutely have to share this with everyone and warn them. Ukraine is now accusing Russia of using spy balloons. So I guess they, I'm not making this up. This just came across the feeds right now on RT. They say that air defense systems near Kyiv allegedly detected and shot down as many as 6 air balloons believed to have been used by Russia. That's coming from a spokesperson for the Ukrainian military who claimed this during a televised appearance on Wednesday. According to Yuri Ignat, the balloons, which were detected flying above the Ukrainian capital, may have been equipped with reconnaissance equipment meant to identify and exhaust Kyiv's air defense system. So the spy balloon story's not going away, and it's just going to keep rehashing itself with different countries now. But on to the main topic here, because this is fascinating. Also by RT, they say that Kyiv, well, this is not them, but the defense ministry in Moscow is warning that Kyiv and its Western supporters are planning to accuse Russia of contaminating parts of Ukraine with radiation from the Chernobyl exclusion zone. Norway was named as one of the alleged co-conspirators. A statement from the ministry on Tuesday asserted that Kyiv will accuse the Russian military of breaching safety protocols when it controlled the Chernobyl nuclear power plant last year. This seems complicated. It will be claimed that Russian troops spread radioactive materials across Ukraine and looted the containment and control facilities, the ministry added. The Chernobyl site, of course infamous for the 1986 disaster, was under Russian control between February 24th and April 28th. In September, the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA, reported on nuclear safety in Ukraine, detailing its visits to the exclusion zone amid the armed conflict. The UN nuclear watchdog confirmed that despite some damage to equipment, Ukrainian personnel had maintained, quote, the holistic security integrity of all major nuclear facilities, end quote, while workers could not rotate for longer periods during the Russian presence and had some additional exposure to radiation. The report stated, quote, no health effects would be expected to be observed, end quote. The IAEA also addressed Kyiv's claim of looting by, quote-unquote marauders at the Chernobyl site. It assessed that the alleged incidents, quote, did not pose a significant radiological risk, since all activities involving the handling of radioactive material were stopped, end quote, under Russian control. According to the Russian Defense Ministry, the accusations against Moscow will form part of a publicity campaign by Kyiv to sway global public opinion in its favor next week when the Russian military operation is set to enter its second year. The claims will be based on falsified or misleading evidence, the statement said. It added that Norwegian nuclear safety experts were involved in assessing the supposed radiation contamination of the Kyiv region. Ignar Amundsen, the head of the Norwegian Radiation Protection Authority, the DSA, confirmed that the agency had deployed specialists to Chernobyl to assess the situation on the ground. Quote, some radioactive dust was stirred up as a result of Russian troops driving into contaminated areas, he told the Dagbladet newspaper, adding that there were, quote, no registered health and environmental consequences, end quote. He denied that the DSA was involved in any scientific malpractice in Ukraine. So I don't know. Is Russia maybe guilty of doing something and they're putting this story out? Or do they have some super keen intelligence and they know, hey, here's the next move coming out of Kyiv? What do you think?
I think it'd be really cool to visit the Chernobyl site. I like hanging out in the zone. Have you ever played that Stalker video game? It's like the Russian Fallout. They've created this post-apocalypse video game. But yeah, it just that story sounds ridiculous. That the Russians were saying that, you know, what the Ukrainians would be saying, that the claim that Russian troops spread radioactive materials across Ukraine and looted the containment and control facilities. Like, that doesn't make any sense from like any strategic perspective. It's just, it's pretty clownish behavior. I don't know what it would achieve. So even that story on its face doesn't make any sense. And yeah, we keep hearing this talk of false flags. Biden, actually, those words actually came out of his mouth a couple months back, and it's the number one tool that works. And so I think most definitely we can expect false flag operations. I guess the key to prevent them is to get the information out, but I feel sometimes even the powers that be have so much hubris, I don't know what they still, you know, go through with it. And everybody, I always make this point, for me it's important, I think many governments use false flag operations. You look at all the different, the world wars, you know, the Japanese, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, dressed up as Chinese soldiers, faked an attack as a pretext to enter Japan. I believe the 1999 Moscow apartment bombings was Russian false flag operation. Of course, 9/11. And so it's a common strategy, but it's funny, no one outs each other usually. So yeah, you know, your further thoughts.
Yeah, that's what's really interesting about this is, like, you know, not that long ago, just talking about false flags, you're like, oh, shut up, you conspiracy theorist, and then the military generals just wink and nod at each other like, yep, that's definitely what we do. But the I don't think I've ever really seen this phenomenon of recent where other powers are world powers are accusing the other ones ahead of time of conducting or planning false flag attacks. That's like new to me. I must have missed something somewhere. So I wanted to bring this one to you because you seem to know a lot about false flags. And the whole story and what the plan is, if it's legit, seems so ridiculous on its face. But then, you know, that story I opened up with, Ukraine is, they're coming out saying, oh, we got spy balloons too. So the world is crazy. Ukraine is crazy. Russia's crazy. We're all crazy. So I guess I wouldn't put it past either of them. Maybe some of the Russian boys did some stuff they weren't supposed to, and this is a cover up for their actions. Who the heck knows? But man, it's so clown world. I wouldn't be surprised if Kyiv is like, yeah, we're gonna say that we did this and they did this and this. And it's just, it doesn't even make any darn sense. And maybe that's the point. Maybe this waters down the concept of false flags so that when one really happens, no one will see it or recognize it for what it is. Who knows?
All I can say is get some popcorn and your favorite drink and enjoy the show. And every day, something new they're throwing at us. I mean, I can't even catch up with the previous day's news. Like today, just now, Black Hawk helicopter crashes in the highway in Alabama, killing all personnel on board. You've got like multiple train derailments. There's not even one, just one in Ohio. It's like half a dozen or something. I don't know what's, I have no idea what's going on. Something else has to be going on. You don't just have military helicopters dropping in Alabama, train derailments, balloons, Ukrainian balloons in Russia, false flag warnings. I mean, it's almost maybe World War III has already started and they're trying to like keep it under wraps for as long as possible. Crazy Town Ruckus, check in with you next hour. We've got our guest Nikolai Petro about to join us and phone lines are open. Feel free to call in and ask questions. Phone numbers are at the top of TNTRadio.live. We'll be right back after this break.
TNT Radio's Joe Hoff.
Yeah, I grew up watching football. I grew up with my dad, my brother sitting in front of the TV and watching my favorite team, the Minnesota Vikings, was for me the purple people eaters, as they said, and it was great. And then, of course, the left is going to come in and radically try to challenge it. And they had this clever idea. Let's bring up, let's get this guy that's no longer a very good quarterback, Kaepernick. And let's have him start kneeling during the national anthem because the U.S. is so bad and because we are so racist. And then they allowed that to happen, and then they allowed other people to join him. And then, quite frankly, that killed their fan base. It was horrible. I stopped watching. President Trump was like, you need to stop this. This is gross. This is a great country with great people. What are you doing? And the far left, they're on a mission to destroy everything good about America. So they kept at it. They made him into this hero. He's no hero. He wasn't that great of a quarterback after 1 year. It was horrible what he was doing. He was sitting on the bench. I guess he thought maybe he could do that and get some money for doing it. So what a mess that was. And then they brought in Black Lives Matter.
Joe Hoff on TNT Radio.
Public school is the instituted agency of socialism throughout every community.
The U.S. government has no authority to have any role in education.
We're going to lose our very republic if we don't stop this indoctrination of children in government schools.
What happened to us in China can happen here.
Have one kind of education and then call it equity.
It's about outcomes. It's about trying to force us all to be equal.
I think we're going to have a race civil war in our hands.
We are exposing kids to pornography as early as kindergarten. Parents just don't know.
No, not anymore. Not anymore. Parents need to wake up. They don't have the interests of your child at heart.
Truth and Lies in American Education at SalemNow.com.
Like Bob Marley said,
get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
From big tech censorship to calling out government tyranny, TNT Radio has the guts to say what you're thinking and gives you the platform to be heard. Call the open line anytime in the U.S. and Canada. Call 1-888-201-6425. In the U.K., call 033-024-1026. And in Australia and New Zealand, call 1-800-670-310.
Stand up for your right.
Free speech has a home on TNT Radio.
If you want to find yourself on a government watch list, then call in to TNTRadio.live. I'm just kidding, but not really. Joining us now is Professor Nikolai Petro. He's a professor of political science at the University of Rhode Island. He's got a long bio. He's a recipient of two Fulbright Awards, one to Russia, one to Ukraine. His latest book is The Tragedy of Ukraine, just published this year. He's also written Ukraine in Crisis, Crafting Democracy, and a number of other books. As a Council on Foreign Relations Fellow, he served as a Special Assistant for Policy toward the Soviet Union in the U.S. Department of State from 1989 to 1990. And he's got numerous scholarly publications and written from everything from The Nation to New York Times. Check out his website, npetro.net. Welcome to TNT Radio, Professor Petro.
Nice to be with you.
I was checking out some of your interviews. I saw you were recently with David Swanson on his World Beyond War. I actually went to Russia with him 6 years ago with Sharon Tennyson. We hung out with the late Gorby and Vladimir Posner and others. And I also saw you co-wrote an article with Gilbert Doctorow at National Interest. I spoke with Gilbert this week on my podcast. So we've got some mutual friends, and I follow your writing.
Interesting people to be talking to.
Yeah, most definitely. And finally, I get to talk to you as well. I followed your writings through different newsletters I subscribe to. And maybe if you want to just tell us briefly about yourself and you know, your main research focus.
For many years, I've specialized on Russian politics mostly, mainly internal, although I did co-author a textbook on Russian foreign policy. And then starting in about 2010, I started to switch to Ukrainian affairs. I got invited to speak in Ukraine by the Ukrainian Academy of Sciences. I think that was 2008. And then over the next 2 years, I got invited back to talk to several universities. And I began to take a deeper interest in Ukraine, actually more than Russia in recent years. And so I guess I'm one of those people who can claim to have studied both countries.
And, you know, we need people like yourself right now, because there's a lot going on with Ukraine and Russia and beyond. And, you know, it's a global situation. It can flare up into a third world war. But I think sometimes we need to pause and look back at the history. And there's a lot of debated history in your book, looking at the chapters. For example, the second chapter of your book is titled Two Nations in One State. And then there's the debate over the origins of Rus. And so, you know, not to have this, we don't have the time to have this long history lesson, but if you want to sort of comment, you know, based on your research, you know, how do you sort of see, you know, the origins of Rus? Because, you know, the Russians will use it as a basis for their advance and, you know, Ukraine vice versa. What are your thoughts here?
Well, there didn't used to be much debate. But since I'd say 2010 and the rise of a curriculum of within Ukraine devoted to the affirmation of a Ukrainian national identity as being anything but Russian, sort of the definition of being Ukrainian is being the opposite of Russia. And ever since that has come about, there has been an effort to redefine all of the conventional wisdom that has been taught over decades and centuries. And this, of course, began within Ukraine, but it has spread more recently to Western scholarship through the Ukrainian emigre community. Which has pushed this as an issue of vital importance to the establishment of an independent Ukrainian nation. And they may have a point with that, because I remember a quote by Viktor Yushchenko, the former president, who regretfully said that Ukraine, even today, he said, in 2012, is still a quasi-nation, precisely because it hadn't really fully distinguished itself from Russia, and it hadn't really tackled the issue of its own Russian identity and its the part of the population which feels strong sympathies toward Russia. And that's a problem that I don't think any war is going to solve. That's just going to be a matter of time and individual preference, which takes generations.
And, you know, going speeding through history as well, you know, other in your chapter, you deal with Ukraine and the Russian Empire. And, you know, in the Soviet Union, we've all heard of Khrushchev giving gifting independence back to Ukraine. Any thoughts on that? And I mean, this is really a complicated situation. I mean, I've met Russians, I've met Ukrainians, and it's really hard to figure out.
Well, it is, because there are so many interconnections, so many mutual ties. And the best way to think of it, I think, is to think of a family feud. And in this case, perhaps one member of the family, maybe the older brother, I don't want to make too much of this analogy because some people get offended by the notion of an older brother. But let's say one brother is older and the younger brother says, I hate you. I've decided we're not related. And the older brother goes, well, no matter what you might say, we're still going to be related. And how does that get resolved? You know, especially when the two parts of the family, the two brothers, have nowhere to go from each other. They're condemned to live and interact with each other throughout all eternity. That's the situation we have.
Yeah, that is actually very helpful. We're going to have to jump to our break. Again, if anyone wants to call in, phone lines are open. Please do so. Don't be lazy and don't be shy. We'll be right back after this update.
I have some even more exciting news.
TNT Radio News.
This is James O'Neill with a check of today's headlines. Japan is considering easing the rules for using force against any intrusions by foreign balloons, according to its defense ministry, after reports that Chinese balloons had been seen flying over the country in the past years. A man has become the eighth British national to die in Ukraine since the start of Russia's invasion on February 24th of 2022. The identity of the individual is not yet known, but the UK Foreign Office said their family has been informed.
Why not give TNT Radio a follow? We're on all major social platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Gab, and Getter. Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time right here on today's News Talk. TNT Radio. TNT Radio.
We're back with Professor Nikolai Petro. You can check out his website at npetro.net and his latest book, The Tragedy of Ukraine, What Classical Greek Tragedy Can Teach Us About Conflict Resolution. And, to look at the 2000s in Ukraine, what has gone on with these revolutions. I'm an American, originally born in the U.S., but I'm also a Croatian. I've lived in Croatia. I'm a citizen as well, and I'm a Slav. And I kind of view as one big brotherhood, the Croats, the Serbs, the Russians, the Ukrainians. I spent a couple of years in Kazakhstan, and I can understand automatically 50% Russian. Like, the numbers are the same in Russian or Croatian, and so many similarities. And that's sort of my view, but I can't deny, from my perspective, there's been meddling. Everyone's been meddling, but you had the 2004 Orange Revolution and then the 2014 Maidan. And maybe for listeners out there who aren't so well-versed in this, for you, what is important when considering, the Orange Revolution and Maidan and how that impacts what's going on right now?
I've always thought of this conflict as having multiple levels. So there is the conflict between the West, NATO, and Russia over who gets to control the destiny of Ukraine, I would say. And they're fighting over who has a proprietary ownership of the assets of that country. And that's part of a larger geopolitical conflict, which that's the one that I think has the potential to escalate into World War III. Then there's a long-standing conflict that goes back several decades and perhaps even centuries between the intellectual elites of Russia. I'm talking, of course, mostly about Moscow and St. Petersburg, and their counterparts in places like Kiev and Kharkiv in Ukraine, over who are they to each other. And at different points in time, Ukrainians have identified as or try to identify as something very distinct from Russians, and other times that hasn't been as important. And there have always been us within the Ukrainian intellectual elite and the Russian intellectual elite a variety of attitudes toward that. It didn't seem to be an especially important issue before Ukraine gained its independence as a nation state in 1991. And the third and least discussed aspect of this conflict, but the one that I talk about the most in my book, is the conflict within Ukraine over who gets to define Ukrainian identity. Is it the Galician nationalists in Western Ukraine who have a very particular definition of what it means to be Ukrainian, focusing on a Greek Catholic religious identity and the use of their own particular dialect of Ukrainian and spreading it throughout all of Ukrainian territory, if not further to what they consider historical Ukrainian lands in Russia, versus the eastern and southern Russophile sections of Ukraine. I don't say that they are Russians themselves. They don't identify as Russians necessarily. I would say most of them have not since independence, but they see themselves as having a close affinity with Russian culture, and they don't see that as a problem for their own Ukrainian civic and national identity. They see themselves as having, in other words, a composite identity, a Russian cultural as well as Ukrainian cultural identity, and they don't understand why the government in Kyiv is trying to force them to make a choice between the two. And that has spawned all sorts of conflicts within Ukraine over the last 30 years. And now we see, since 2014, a perpetual military conflict having grown out of this cultural divide.
Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. And maybe to ask you, you know, I've talked to a number of people. We hear this talk about, you know, from the Russians, denazification, Bandera. And I've heard people tell me that a third of Ukrainian military forces are, you know, Nazis. What's your, according to your understanding of what's going on with this Ukrainian Nazism?
Well, I view Nazism and the Nazi Party as relating to Germany, to World War II Germany. Throughout Eastern Europe, both in the 1930s and afterwards, there have been similar parties, but with distinctions. In other words, the Hungarians added something of their own. The Romanians added something of their own. The Spanish Falangists added something of their own. And what unites all of these groups and their Ukrainian brethren is the idea of a hyper-nationalism. In other words, they are not so much Nazis or fascists in the conventional sense, but they are ardent nationalists. And nationalism, when taken to its logical extreme, is simply a form of totalitarianism because it places your national identity above every other value. And ultimately, as the founding fathers of the Ukrainian nationalist movement wrote, it should be more important than your family, more important than your children. You should be willing to sacrifice everything for the well-being of your nation. And of course, the nation becomes a substitute family and has its own father figure. Of course, there are similarities to what we historically think of as Nazism and fascism, but it's an evolution of that. It's a modernized version of that, that serves the purpose of being a rallying cry in Ukraine in its fight for, its fight against Russian invasion today.
Yeah, and I think that was a good explanation, because as well in one of my homelands, Croatia, we also, we had the Croatian variety of Nazism, as you mentioned, in these other countries as well, from 41 to 44, Ante Pavelic. Mm-hmm. And my Croatian grandfather was a prisoner of this Croatian Nazi regime for 6 months. He survived. He died in his old age, but I think he was a partisan. We don't know all the details, but in your book, you also discussed the tragedies of Crimea and Donbass. And as I mentioned previously, I think it was 2017, so that's what, 6 years ago, I accompanied David Swanson and Rick Sterling and others with Sharon Tennyson and her Center for Citizens Initiative to Russia for 3 weeks. And some of us ended up in Kazan, Tatarstan, mm-hmm. talking to mm-hmm. Russians there. And, you know, some Crimeans that we met were telling us that, you know, the majority of people in Crimea wanted to return, I think 2014, wanted to reconnect with Russia. What are your thoughts on, you know, the tragedy of Crimea?
So I have a chapter in my book on Crimea, and then I wrote a piece, I think last month, in Responsible Statecraft, reminding people of the historic roots of the conflict of the Crimean region with the Ukrainian state, which began before Ukraine declared its independence in 1991. Already the local Crimean parliament asserted its own sovereignty from both the Ukrainian SSSR, to which it had been gifted by Khrushchev in 1954, and from the USSR. And the objective of declaring this sovereignty was to have the ability to join in what Mikhail Gorbachev was offering at the time as an alternative to the collapsing Soviet Union, a new union forged around a voluntary association. And Crimeans, well, the Crimean government, I should say, at that time did not want to join this new union as part of Ukraine, but as its own entity. Well, over time, it became a contentious issue within Ukraine itself, and there was a lot of back and forth and conflict, social conflict, sometimes erupting into low-scale violence in both Crimea and Donbass, because what they were hoping for since 1991 was actually some form of federalism, some form of recognition by the Kievan government of their own regional distinctiveness. And if that had been granted, they would have been happy, I think, at that time to remain within Ukraine as Ukrainian citizens. But they just wanted their own local distinctiveness, including the ability, among other things, to speak their native language, which predominates in eastern and southern Ukraine, and of course in Crimea, Russian, but that was not considered an acceptable compromise to the nationalists who were already starting to take the upper hand in Kiev at the time, and since 2014. Since the Maidan, there has been essentially a refusal to even engage in any compromise over the issue of how to get the people in eastern Ukraine, southern Ukraine, and Crimea, whom they say they want to return to Ukraine, but what are they going to offer them? Under what terms are they supposed to rejoin Ukraine? The only terms actually that have been offered to them by the Kievan government in recent laws passed is that of a subjugated and defeated population.
Yeah, it's interesting. We also read, I think a week or two ago, the Pentagon came out and said that for the foreseeable future, they don't see it being possible, Ukraine taking Crimea back. I think we'll jump to our break Again, a reminder, people can call in. Phone numbers are listed at the top left of TNTRadio.live. Ask any question you like, and you can find all of Professor Petro's work at npetro.net and check out his latest book, The Tragedy of Ukraine, What Classical Greek Tragedy Can Teach Us About Conflict Resolution. We'll be right back on TNT Radio.
De-weaponizing weather
with reality and perspective.
So the Los Angeles Times today put out an article on how bad the drought is in California and how bad it is with the snowpack overall. And I can't really argue with that overall, but it is very interesting that their timing is occurring after what has been a 90-day period of well below normal temperatures and much above normal snowfall. And this kind of pattern is going to continue into the spring in the western part of the United States. Dramatic new images show parched Lake Oroville transformed by these storms, dump trillions of gallons of rain on the state, leading to flooding, but also boosting drought-strapped reservoirs. Not only did it do that, but it is building the snowpack across the western part of the United States. It's about as good as it's been in about 50 years. Do you hear anybody talking about that? Of course not. This is TNT Climate and Weather Watchdog meteorologist Joe Bastardi asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you've got.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
The 9/11 terrorist attacks led to the so-called War on Terror. But there's another side to 9/11 which, unlike the mainstream media, TNT Radio won't censor. Consider Building 7, the third World Trade Center building, which collapsed later that same fateful day. Professor of Civil Engineering, Dr. J. Leroy Hulsey, led a research team which demonstrated that the official US government version of the Building 7 collapse is a scientific fraud that defies the laws of physics. This leaves us with some very troubling questions about the entire 9/11 attacks. Dr. Hulsey's team issued a final report in March of 2020. It concluded, "The collapse of WTC-7 was a global failure involving the near-simultaneous failure of all the columns in the building and not a progressive collapse involving the sequential failure of columns throughout the building."
The Green New Deal supports the abuse and murder of children in the Congo, mining for cobalt for the electric vehicle. We mandate that the truth be told. TNT Radio.
On our final segment with Professor Nikolai Petro, check out his latest book, The Tragedy of Ukraine. He writes prolifically for a number of publications, which you can all follow through his website, npetro.net. And just continuing along with, we were talking about Crimea, and now Donbass, which seems to have been the, I guess, one of the main reasons or pretext for Russia to enter, 1 year ago. The Ukrainian government had been, I guess, shelling Donbass and I guess, abusing the people there for a while. And so they're asking for help. And then Russia comes in. Some people have talked about us ending up in like a North Korea, South Korea, like demilitarized zone where the conflict just freezes and that, you know, Donbass, that eastern part of Ukraine, just stays as it is. You know, what insights can you give us as into the whole Donbass situation?
I think it's impossible to say what the outcome is likely to be. There's far too many variables. I have from the beginning, admitting my own ignorance about all things military, it seems clear to me that the military conflict itself, how it is resolved, will determine the political outcome. So no negotiations are possible until it is commonly accepted by all the sides in the conflict, and that includes the West, that the outcome now is inevitable. And I think one of the things that is leading to this war being prolonged is the hope, I would say the hope beyond hope, by certain politicians in the West that Ukraine can somehow win this conflict with Russia. And on the other side, of course, are those who look at the power disparity, the population disparity, and the extent of the commitment that Russia now feels, which I don't think it felt at the beginning of the conflict, and contrasting that to the capabilities and the commitment of Ukraine, and saying there's no way in the long run that Ukraine can succeed. So it's best to therefore sue for peace sooner and save more lives. And that's the debate. When it becomes readily apparent to everybody what the inevitable outcome is, that's when negotiations become possible, not before then.
Yeah, that's, that just seems logical. And I've also had that view as well, that, you know, based on how things go on the military field, then we'll see. Both sides will see what they can get. And
the only thing I would add to that, sorry for interjecting, is that we on the outside cannot know what the actual military situation is. Mm-hmm. There's simply so much massive disinformation about everything that as soon as I see somebody, and it doesn't matter who, it doesn't matter what rank, say, this is the way it is, I know that it's what they want you to believe rather than what they truly believe.
And this is actually what I said even since last year, like half a year ago, where I just stopped following the daily situation. And, you know, you've got Russian sources, you've got Ukrainian sources you don't know what to believe. And you see videos on the telegrams and everywhere. And it's like, you don't know when these videos were taken, what was with the technology we have today. It's just, and the resources it takes daily to try and follow the situation. I'm like, I just sort of wait for bigger markers to present themselves that tell us.
Yeah, it's better to follow it once every month or so, sort of get an overview. And of course, try to find, this is my advice to my students, try to find, if possible, some source that really doesn't care. That is truly like a pox on both your houses. You know, maybe some Latin American source, maybe some African source, you know, but that really doesn't have a stake in the game, that isn't owned by one of the two sides. That's your only hope to get at least some perspective on what might actually be happening.
Yeah, and looking at the piece, the road to peace, peace talks, I studied at the Geneva School of Diplomacy, and you mentioned in one of your chapters, flawed peace from Geneva to Minsk. We heard recently Merkel, I guess, sort of admit that, yeah, we weren't serious about the Minsk agreement. And then I think Lavrov responded then basically saying, like, we can't trust at all anymore the West. What's your take on Minsk and you know, trying to, is there any future for peace deals?
I am one of those people who don't read too much into these late statements by Hollande, the French president at the time, and Merkel, that they were aiming to rearm Ukraine. They were, but that much almost seems obvious. I would say that the West, as it did in 2014 in February during the Maidan revolt, they kept multiple irons in the fire at the same time. In other words, on the one hand, if the outcome on the ground had been a government of national unity, and there'd been a peaceful transition of power as had been negotiated on February 20th from Yanukovych to the opposition, they would have gone along with that. But when a better deal came up the next day, better from their perspective, giving them more of what they wanted in the long term, setting Russia back, in other words, on the back foot in its position in Ukraine, then why not go for that? Of course, you know, it's kind of a no-brainer. So I think it's not so much that the West consciously try to arm Ukraine as an alternative to peace. It's just that they, as is the convention, I think, of Western diplomacy in many cases around the world, they speak with out of two sides of their mouth. On the one hand, they want peace. On the other hand, they're not averse to getting an advantage out of the continuation of the conflict. And as a result, what do they get out of this? What do Western governments get out of this? They get to go home to their constituencies, and say that no matter what happened, they won. You know, it turned out well for them. And that's really the bottom line for any Western politician.
Yeah, and I did want to get maybe your thoughts on some of these figures now that are world famous, infamous, you know, for example, Zelensky, and a lot of us make fun of him. There's basically no politician that I don't make fun of. You know, I'll poke fun at everyone. But what sort of your assessment of Zelensky, you know, from your perspective? You know, we have this comedian, actor, now president. You know, lately there seems to be this trend. You know, Trump, this businessman, becomes president. I think there are a few other countries where we have outsiders come in. What's your take on Zelensky?
Being an actor or a businessman or a lawyer is not a disqualification for being a great leader. But being a great leader, political leader, I think ultimately requires putting aside your personal ambitions, and this is especially difficult, even your personal security and safety for the good of the country. I have written several times in over the past several years, since 2019, when Zelensky was elected, I, like many people in Ukraine, were impressed by his courage in taking on the Ukrainian establishment at the time. And that's Petro Poroshenko, his predecessor. A Petro Poroshenko, who was at that time the favored candidate of Vice President Biden and the Obama administration. And so he stood against that and articulated a message which was very popular, that gained him overwhelming support throughout the country, the first time that's ever happened, because it was a message of peace and reconciliation both within the country and between Ukraine and Russia. Then, however, as often happens in Ukrainian politics, he settles down. He finds that running for office is not the same as having the personnel to govern. And to govern, you need personnel in the region who are loyal to you. And that resulted very quickly in a number of major gaps in his administration and to a precipitous decline in his popularity, which was barely above 10% by 2020. So within a year and a half after his election. And then he decided on a tack of shutting down the opposition news. He took out the three major television networks, fired, 3,000 journalists lost their jobs in Ukraine, the only ones who were truly independent of the government and critical of it. And then he began to systematically dismantle the political opposition, who are today, in the aftermath of the invasion of Russia, they have been suspended and disbanded, all the opposition political parties. And this gave him a boost. not to any high levels of popularity, but it allowed his personal popularity to stabilize at around 20 to 25%. And that's where we were before the Russian invasion. Now, of course, he is a wartime leader. And like any wartime leader, even despite what we know in retrospect of the personalities and the foibles of many of these leaders that we now idolize, he can do no wrong right now. But should the war end, I suspect his popularity will then begin to decline as sharply as Churchill's did after World War II.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you for joining us on TNT Radio, Professor Petro. Everyone, check out his latest book, The Tragedy of Ukraine, from De Gruyter, and his website, npetro.net. I think we're going to have to get you on Twitter. I don't believe you're on Twitter, Professor Petro. But again, thank you for joining us on TNT Radio.